Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Forever Dog.
Hello, everyone. I'm Jinx Monsoon, and welcome to Hi Jinx, a podcast where I, an internationally tolerated drag superstar, get to interview compelling and fascinating people about how they became who they are and why they do what they do. Today, we are joined by actor, comedian, writer, director, drag queen, producer, and one of my very best friends. It's Ben de la Creme. Hi, Ben de la Creme.
Hi, Jinx. Did that sound like how you say it?
Yeah. Hi, Jinx.
Hi, Jinx. Hi, Jinx.
Do you have a Jinx Monsoon impression?
I really don't.
Most people.
Oh, wait, this is it. It's interrupting.
Are way off the mark.
It's talking over you.
Do I talk over you all?
No, you totally don't. No. I like to joke that I can't get words in edgewise with you, but the reality is that frequently I barely, like that interview we did yesterday.
That interview we did yesterday where I was like.
it was a 20 minute interview and you were 10 minutes late. So I had to talk for the first 10 minutes. And then by the time you got there, I was so used to talking that I kept forgetting to even let you answer questions.
I'm so embarrassed. I've been pretty damn good about being on time, at least for interviews and podcast recordings and things. And yesterday was a doozy.
It's hard. A
20 minute interview and I was 10 minutes late.
Drag is hard, but also like. Home drag is hard.
I was like a phantom in that interview, too. Home drag is hard. It's really difficult to separate your work and life when they're all intermingled. I mean, our work and life is already intermingled, and then you layer in the pandemic, and we're literally working from home. I find that it's difficult to find moments in my life to stop talking about drag and stop talking about work because I feel like when you create the work for yourself, your brain is always kind of thinking about what's going to be my next bit, what's going to be something that's happening in my real life that's going to make its way into my next show. And then once you get me started talking about that, it never ends. Do you feel like it's similar for you?
I mean, do you know how hard it is for me not to be talking to you about scheduling right now? we're obviously in the throes of creating this, our new tour for this year. And it's like, we're meeting every day and we're talking about this stuff every day. And I have to say that it is actually so hard for me to switch gears, but at the same time, I'm actually really happy that we have a contained amount of time where we're not going to talk about that. I think that's a delightful shift for us.
We have 1 hour's worth of conversation that's not about our hit show returning to tour this winter. It's called The Return of the Jinx and De La Holiday Show Live. Really gives you everything you need to know in that one title.
It's going to be really good. I think it's not that we can't mention it or whatever, because obviously
we already did.
We did and we're going to, and it's a major part of our lives. But what was I going to say?
It's nice to be talking about other things between the two of us. And it's so funny because that is an example of us both being workaholics, is that the only way for us to have a friendly conversation that's not about work is we have to schedule a podcast recording.
Yeah.
So for any of our listeners who don't already know, which I'm sure it's a very small percentage, but we've known each other for 12 years now.
I think that's right.
12 years. And we started collaborating pretty much from the get-go. I know you've told this story countless times.
You know, I was actually thinking about this ahead of time, though. Don't you think it would be nice if we didn't tell the story of how we met? Because every single interview we've ever we always tell that same story. Do you want to? We could, but
I'll tell the listeners. You can find it basically anywhere else, but the very concise version is we both knew about each other through word of mouth. And then one day, Dayla came to see me performing at a Starbucks at 4 p.m. for free in Seattle, and dropped her business card. And soon after that, we were collaborating because we realized very quickly, due to our shared aesthetic and shared performance styles, our similar performance aesthetics, whatever terminology you want to use, we knew that if we didn't work together as friends, we were going to end up being highly competitive with one another and be frenemies instead. Yeah. So
I'm really proud of us for both making that choice and really sticking to it and really working at it, because, you know, it is a challenge to be close friends with somebody who works in your same industry, who is as insanely talented as you are.
Insanely untalented.
But when I tell this story, I want to point out that when I tell that story, I really like to milk the details about how it was free in the middle of the afternoon, how there were 10 folding chairs, how you were changing in one of those bathrooms with the code on the door. The code on the door is like a special detail to me. How there was like milk foaming sounds in the background while you were singing.
And one of my favorite details is it was a Starbucks, but it was called Roy Street Coffee and Tea because it was when Starbucks was trying to blend in with local coffee shops. I don't know if any of those like secret Starbucks still exists. But
was that a thing that happened in other places besides Seattle, or was that like,
I don't know.
I feel like Seattle is like so snobby about coffee in a good way. I'm snobby about coffee, but you know, Starbucks is obviously birthed in Seattle, and Seattle is fully turned on it now that it's like a big.
Seattle loves to play the elitist game.
I mean, me
really
too. I get it.
Really just rolled over and took it when it came to gentrification. Like, Portland has been gentrified but has fought back. Seattle just kind of lubed up and put its ass in the air and said, gentrify me, daddy.
Seriously. And it's like, I mean, I think San Francisco is sort of the closest gentrification equivalent in terms of what the culture was like and how it's changed. But San Francisco, it happened over the course of like a decade. And in Seattle, it happened in like 6 months.
Yeah, I left for tour once and then came back, and Michelle Visage was in Seattle with me. I tried to take her to three different like shopping spots that I liked. They were all gone. And in one case, the building was gone.
Yes, it was the city was like leveled while we were on an airplane. It was crazy.
It felt like Poltergeist. It felt like I showed up to show her my haunted house and there was just an empty lot there. Now, Dayla.
Yeah,
yes. I know, as your friend, that you are... I think lots of drag queens are obsessed with horror movies, but you and I share a special love of horror movies, as in I think we go for the same kind of things in horror movies.
Yes.
Since it's Octoberween while we're recording this, do you have any horror movie recommendations for our listeners? Hopefully it'll still be somewhere near Halloween and people will still be in the scary movie mood.
Well,
but give us a quick short list of recommendations.
Yeah, I mean, my number one is always the same. And I don't care. I mean, you can air this like at Easter and people should still watch this. But The Haunting, the one from 1963, not the terrible remake from like the late 90s, early 2000s, is, I think, the best horror movie ever made in the history of the universe, which I know is bold, but it's been sort of reimagined countless times. The Haunting of Hill House series that came out like mm-hmm. a few years ago. That was also based on the book that The Haunting is based on, which is called The Haunting of Hill House. Anyway, it's just an incredible movie, and it has just like these really, really strong lesbian, I can't call them subtexts because they're just texts. It's just like there's a fully like, you know, they're a little bit, you know, subtle about the, like, they don't just say like, hey, look, a lesbian. But other than that, it's just like this character is
that's
very
the one thing they don't say.
Yeah.
Is, hey, I mean, look, a lesbian.
They very much acknowledge it. And then it's, you know, and there's just this like big push pull between the protagonist, the female protagonist, and this woman. And, you know, and, but it's also like a beautiful haunting story about this like crazy house that's like pulling this woman into the brink of insanity. But it's all kind of this lovely metaphor for internalized homophobia. But it's also just like a gorgeous movie. Like, the house is so campy. It looks like Liberace as a house. And it's just, and it's beautiful. And it's like, and it is genuinely scary, but like, you never see a monster. Like, everything is like sound and camera angles. And you're like, is the protagonist going crazy, or is there truly a haunting? And it just rides that line beautifully.
Well, I've told you before, I read the book, and it's, the book is a beautifully written Victorian horror, but admittedly kind of boring, and and ends with a bit of a shrug, but I kind of love things that end on a shrug.
Well, you know, I think that the end, what it doesn't give you is the satisfaction that I think we've gotten very used to in a lot of contemporary media, which is like a definitive answer, you yeah. know. And I like that it doesn't. It leaves you with a sense of wondering still, which I enjoy.
I definitely know that I've been conditioned to expect a definitive answer at the end of films, or at least enough clues where it feels pretty like you can pretty much deduce what the end is, you know, even if they ended on a question or land on a cliffhanger at the end of the film. What I don't like is when I feel like a film just ends with like, well, it's open to the audience to interpret, just because they couldn't figure out how to end their film.
Oh, that drives me crazy. Like, when I feel like the filmmaker, yeah, when I feel like the filmmaker didn't plan an ending, and so they like stopped, that makes me feel nuts. And I don't want to call out the films that I've seen recently that did that, but I've seen quite a few.
I'll call out one. I really enjoyed watching the film The Green Knight. I really enjoyed watching it. Now, unless you have a history professor's worth of knowledge of the original, like, King Arthur Green Knight fable from...
I mean, I don't know what you're talking about right now. I don't know the fable. I don't know the thing.
England.
I don't know the movie you're talking about.
I had to watch two different, like, synopses on The Green Knight just to understand what I had just watched. But it was one of those beautifully shot, beautifully performed films that you just kind of enjoy watching it, even if the entire time you're thinking, like, what? Who's this witch? Who's this headless girl?
I went to a fine art school, so I literally just watched hours and hours of like video art, which is, I mean, you know, you're just watching people like in black and white, like roll around in like paint on the floor, or like sit in a bathtub full of pancakes staring at a wall, or like, it's, yeah.
That was the same with my art school experience, except it wasn't filmed. It was just watching them do it in classrooms.
Oh, yeah, I did that. Yeah, all of it. We got the full shebang. I was in the performance art classes. I was in the film classes. And then, like, the video art stuff is, like, a very specific thing, right? Because it's all about, like, when home movie technology sort of like came to every person. And so it was like this reclamation of like, it's Hollywood's not in charge anymore. But it was this huge overcorrection where people were like, we are going to set ourselves apart from Hollywood by being as boring as humanly possible. It's kind of rough. I mean, some of it's cool, but, you know.
Do you have an art school presentation or project that you did that you're especially ashamed of? I have one. I was in a group where we tried to do a performance art piece called The Women Museum. And it was me and four or five other female students. And we all played female archetypes. My archetype was the drag queen. And we were just like in a living museum and you watched us interact with each other. And it devolved into some kind of cat fight. I don't know. I don't think the rhetoric was sound. I don't think our intention was sound. I think it was just a really, really bad project that we half-assed and made it seem like we had put a lot of work into it. But I think about getting into drag on that day and performing that piece, and it makes me really upset with myself as a as I look back on my life.
First of all, I would like to recognize that our relationship in a nutshell is the fact that you just said, do you have this experience? I have one.
I was giving you an example to build off of.
No, I get it. It was good. I mean, this may shock you, but I was kind of workaholic in I mean, I was very much, I don't know that there's actually any projects I did that I feel ashamed of, because I was always, you know, art, you know, you go to art school and it is that thing where it is so easy to phone it in because everything's subjective, right? Like, so I was oftentimes in classes where people like very clearly, you know, it's like this blank of paper, like here's my blank sheet of paper. Now I'll leave it to the class to interpret it or whatever, right? But I actually was like, I was like meticulous about all of my projects. So it's not that they were all like brilliant. Like I look back and I'm definitely was like, you know, a 22 year old or whatever. But when are you in college? 19? I don't know. But yeah, no, I mean, there's nothing that I'm ashamed of, but I definitely, there's stuff that if I were to say it out loud, sounds pretty bad on paper. Like, you know, I definitely did a piece, you know, because I was doing drag a lot at the time, and I was always told by my, like, professors and peers that, like I involved drag in all of my work, but everybody was like, well, it's kind of, like, it's sort of lowbrow. It's not, like, high art. It's not fine art, right? And, of course, now it's more universally recognized as just a part of our culture, but that drove me fucking nuts. So I, in as revenge, involved it in absolutely everything. But there was one project, for instance, where I was like, okay, well, I'm going to represent femininity, or like the concept of like, you know, whatever, adapting femininity as a male person in a very different way. And so I like made a pair of like men's overalls, like very like, you know, like utilitarian looking overalls, but they were maternity overalls. So they had like, like space for a big pregnancy belly, but then I wasn't in drag in any other way. And it was just me thinking about like, okay, well, like, what is it? You know, like I have like, what is this relationship to not being able to bear children, but feeling like a feminine person or whatever, you know? And like, and then I actually like, it was a photo project and it was me like wearing those overalls, like on the train and like around the city and stuff. Right. So I actually like stand by that project, but when you describe it, it's very art school.
I, while in art school, wore maternity clothes for not projects.
You still kind of do sometimes.
I like an empire waist.
You love an empire waist. And it looks great on you.
In my day-to-day life, in my out-of-drag life.
It's Kaylee Cuoco for Priceline. Ready to go to your happy place for a happy price? Well, why didn't you say so? Just download the Priceline app right now and save up to 60% on hotels. So whether it's Cousin Kevin's Kazoo Concert in Kansas City, go Kevin! Or Becky's Bachelorette Bash in Bermuda, you never have to miss a trip ever again. So download the Priceline app today. Your savings are waiting.
Go to your happy place for a happy price. Go to your happy price, Priceline.
Dayla.
Yes.
I know you so well. I wanted some direction for this podcast so we didn't just sit and talk about, you know, fuck all, as the Brits say.
But, you're so obsessed with British people.
I have to integrate it into my daily speech because I'm practicing for when my husband comes to live with me. I have to be at least
you think there will be too much of a language barrier?
I need to be 10% more British by the time he gets here.
Oh, no.
But I asked our lovely producer, Joseph, if he would write out some questions that he thinks that the fans want to know about us.
Oh, wow.
And our friendship. Some of them are loaded. Some of them are pretty basic. But let's have a go at these and see what bubbles up. First
That's
one.
So formal. I feel like I should have dressed for this occasion.
The first one is loaded. I'm putting it out there. It's a loaded
like
question.
A baked potato.
Has there been anything that has ever come between our relationship?
I mean, in what sense? I mean, I'm like, you know, if we're getting real, I think, you know, our relationship for many years was us really figuring out how to like have the most positive relationship we could. You know, I think we really respected each other. We really liked each other. We really liked working together, but there was a lot of sense of competition. Mm-hmm. And I think that, you know, it's not like that was like a thing. That's not like one thing that stood between us, but I do just feel like it was from the get-go, we could have gone a couple different ways. And we really worked hard, I think, at getting to the relationship we have. And I am like very proud of that for us, because now I think we're just very mutually supportive in a super genuine way.
I would agree. I think there was, you know, the best way to describe the the dynamics our relationship has faced is that throughout the years, we've mentioned to each other when the other one is currently the Meryl. Because we're constantly comparing our friendship to Goldie and Meryl in Death Becomes Her.
Yes.
And there have been times in our friendship where you're the Meryl. I think the beginning of our friendship, for a long time, you were the Meryl. And then there were times where I was the Meryl, and we've kind of flipped back and forth. And then it was a huge question of who would play who when we finally started doing the stage version of
oh, I know.
Of the show. And now it's like we found such a great dynamic with our show, Drag Becomes Her with Peaches Christ, that I can't see it any other way. But behind the scenes, we're constantly flipping who's the Meryl and who's the Goldie.
Now we're like Meryl and Meryl in The Parent Trap.
That's it. We're Meryl and Meryl cast as that. Cast as Lindsay Lohan.
As Lindsay Lohan as Hayley Mills.
Is that that character's name?
No, Hayley Mills is the original actress from the original Parent Trap. You love to only know about a reference and not the source. That is like what you love to like listen to a contemporary old-timey cover but not know the original song. Like That's
a contemporary old-timey cover. That's like just me in a nutshell.
Yeah.
I'm a contemporary old-timey cover.
Also, you can edit this out. You can edit this out if you want. Obviously, your call. But there is the time that I slept with your boyfriend.
No, we won't edit. I was actually thinking about bringing it up, but I didn't know. But it's worth noting, we were in an open relationship, and that person is now one of your very, very good friends. It's just kind of the nature.
It's also worth
the queer community.
It is partially the nature of the queer community, especially a small community like the queer community in Seattle. But also, it was an incredibly bad idea. I knew it. I felt terrible. I apologized profusely, and I still do. But
that's the only.
But we moved through it in like 24 hours.
Yeah, we did. And it's like the only time anything kind of like we've had those personal friend things, especially since you were one of my closest friends during the worst years of my drinking. And you were very, very kind to try your best never to make me feel judged. But you did also at one point say, when you drink, you become a monster. And I just think someone who loves you needed to say that to you. And I'm like, aye, aye, mon capitaine. But yeah, we worked through it. And that's a perfect example of like, you know, we had many moments in our friendship where we could have taken the easy way, which would just kind of been taking a step back from each other and kind of decreasing how present we were in each other's lives. But we always made the choice to work through the hard parts. And now we've like found this really great simpatico energy where we're like two halves of a coin. And now I just want to do everything like in collaboration with you. I'm kind of like, you know, I mean,
are you asking me to start co-hosting this podcast?
Yeah. I mean, we basically collaborated for my wedding.
That was fun. I was very honored that you asked me to master of ceremonies. That it was a lovely event.
I do love, you said, yes, absolutely, I will. What does a master of ceremonies do at a wedding? And I was like, well, it's a Zoom wedding, so we're going to find our own special little way of doing things. But here's a question I think that's also got some history to it. Do we ever feel one is getting the spotlight more than the other?
What is up with it? Like, what are they trying to pull? What is Joseph trying to pull?
Questions first. Oh my gosh, now he's like on the spot editing the doc. BTS.
No, Joseph, you made the decisions. You have to stand by them. All right. So wait, so Joseph's question is, why do we hate each other? Is that what he said?
Do we ever feel like the other one gets the spotlight more? I know... I'll just cop to this, you know, I know, and we've talked about it actually multiple times throughout our friendship, but, you know, I did Drag Race first, and with that came, especially being the first from the Northwest and being the first in Seattle, and then going back into, like we mentioned, the tight-knit, smaller queer community of Seattle, I definitely... point blank, let it go to my head. And
we knew you were still in there, so we stuck with you. But man, that was a rough moment in time.
We knew you were still in there.
Oh, it's like, God. No, it's fully like an exorcism movie where they're like, I know my daughter is still rattling around in there somewhere.
Well, what I will say is I think I was really good at still presenting the me that I thought I was or the me I wanted to be to the public, which means only really the people closest to me saw the most monstrous side effects.
I would agree with that. Yeah.
Success. But what I will say is I, you know, now having worked with and met so many of the winners throughout the years, there's just a certain, there's a certain amount of going to your head that Drag Race just inherently brings with it. And it's part of, it's like a rite of passage.
There's got to be a name for that. We've got to like, it's like the crown crazies or something.
Crazies, the winner's curse. You have to pull yourself back from the brink of it. And I think pretty much every winner has experienced some form of that. And I always say that, you know, the way I was able to come back from the brink of the crown crazies was because I kept the people in my life who told me the truth, and I didn't do Drag Race and then decide to just surround myself with yes people who were going to just, you know, put me in an echo chamber. I had a lot of very close friends, you know, be very honest with me at that time, and it brought me back from the brink of insanity.
Which is great. You know, I mean, that says a lot about you that you'd selected so well, because we all, you know, well, it's just, you know, like, whatever, we all have these moments where we lose ourselves in some way or another, and we hopefully have cultivated friendships that are, like, honest and caring enough to hold us, you know, to hold us accountable.
And to remind us who we were, who we are, and who we are meant to be.
Yeah. Are you reading an embroidered pillow right now?
No, I was looking dead in your eyes. But back to the original question, I would say during that time, I was probably very hard to share a stage with. Whereas nowadays, I think we are very good at, we're very good at sharing a stage. We're very good at taking turns, being the one who's lapping up all the attention. And two drag queens sharing a stage is just a difficult thing, period. You know, like you put two drag queens in one show and it's going to be... it's always going to be a balance and an intricate dance.
I mean, it's not always going to be a balance. And that's why I think it's really awesome that we are good at finding that balance. But yeah, I mean, I think it's, yeah, of course there's been, you know, I mean, whatever. We have taken turns being more in like a wider public spotlight, but... we have always had the same high opinion of each other's work. You know what I mean? Like, we always have our followings. And it might be that, like, you know, TV viewers have, like, a moment of, like, a wider audience kind of getting excited about us for, like, the 10-minute attention span that Drag Race viewers have. But in the end, we both have our followings. We both respect each other's work. And I also think... you know, one of the things is we have gotten to the point where we can be honest with each other about, like, I'm feeling kind of jealous right now. And I think it's like people feel shame and like they don't want to admit when they're jealous. But it's like we have jealousy sometimes and we just say it, you know, and we care about each other. So.
Don't know. I don't have, and I feel like I recently watched, I know I recently watched your season of All Stars, All Stars season 3. And after your time on All Stars, I feel like you kind of, more than your first time on Drag Race, kind of developed a public persona of being someone who talks openly about mental health issues, being an advocate for mental self-care. But I don't remember if you had like specific moments on All Stars where you talked about those things other than just being you and watching how you deal with conflict and deal with problems and how you really process things before you open up about how you're feeling. And you take a lot of responsibility on yourself to figure out things for yourself before you go running back into a situation. Would you agree? Was it more that you led by example than like making the claim like, I am a person who cares about mental health and mental wellness?
Yeah, you know, I mean, I think it was like I knew it was just like, you know, it had been. 6 years or something. And I just, you know, I don't know. I knew more about myself. I know myself better, you know, as we age. But I think that it's funny that you say that because I hadn't really thought about it in quite that respect. But on my first season, season 6, I do talk about having depression. I talk about mental health on the season. But at the same time, on that season, I was terrified. Too terrified to really share myself in like a major way. You know what I mean? And then on All Stars, I went in with a really like, fuck it. Let's just like, you know, I'm just going to like bring myself fully to this experience in a way where it's like, I think I actually did talk about some of that stuff on set, but it didn't make it to air. But I just think that was like, you know, partially a phase in my life I'd reached before that, but weirdly, and this is, you know, people ask me constantly about, you know, self-eliminating, which is like, does get like tiresome to re-explain over and over again. But there is, but I think the more interesting piece of that is that I think I actually discovered a lot about myself and how I wanted to live my life while filming that season. Like, that moment of realizing, because I went in, I mean, you know, I was like going nuts with this internal tug of war before I went on All Stars about like, I really want to do this. Like, I want to be a part of this, but I also don't feel good about what the rules are. I don't feel right about like condoning this and participating. And when I had that like aha moment where I was like, oh my God, I've totally nailed this whole thing. And now I can say that like, I don't actually agree with the terms of this thing. That was like a aha moment about like many broader points of my life. Like I came home from All Stars and like ended shit that had been making me miserable for years and started like redirecting my life. It was like that moment was actually clicked a lot of things in my place into place. And I think a lot of how I've talked about things since then actually stem from some real epiphany that came in those final days of filming.
I don't remember epiphany. Did she go far?
Oh my God.
I will say, as you know, as a longtime friend of yours, I've always been very impressed by the maturity at which you handle conflicts and special challenges. And, you know, I've oftentimes referred to you as my mentor. You're in this realm between my peer, my best friend, and also at many times feel like my mentor. You've been my mentor in business. You've been my mentor in mental health aspects. And I can say, you know, I say openly these days, it took me way too long to start really digging into my own mental self-care and, you know, seeking therapy. And I think a big part of it is someone who's a perfectionist and a workaholic and a type A personality, I feel like I convinced myself that to seek help for these issues meant I couldn't take care of it on my own, so I was failing in some way. Like, oh, I should be able, I'm good at everything else, I should be able to be good at being mentally sound as well. And seeking professional help was something that I didn't do soon enough, but you know, doing it at all is worth it. No matter when you decide to like really dig into your own mental health and really take accountability for your own mental wellness, it's a good time to start at any time.
Yeah, you know, and it's an ongoing thing because I talked about depression on season 6. People are often, and I appear really like, right, my character is super positive. And on those seasons of television, like I'm just sort of on a manic high while I'm there participating in the show. So I seem really chipper, but people are like, it's so cool that you beat depression. I'm like, you don't. Like, that's not a thing. You navigate it for your whole life. And I still get very depressed, but I have gotten a lot better at figuring out that that always ends and not beating myself up for it, which shortens those times of being depressed. And I do think that's really important for people to talk about, because I know that artists talking about that, I mean, I remember like, Chris Cornell from Soundgarden, I read an interview with him about like how he just, despite the fact that Soundgarden was so successful, how he just didn't want to get out of bed for like long periods of time. And I like that article, and I, that was, you know, I was pretty young when I read that, and I was like, oh my God, I'm not broken and I could still have a career, you know?
Yeah.
And so I feel like it's really important that I, you know, continue that, passing along that understanding that this is a common experience and it is something that you can have a good life anyway.
Yeah. That's the important thing, is when you're in the throes of depression, it's really easy to feel like, okay, well, this is me forever now and life is never going to move again and I'm just stuck. But acknowledging those feelings and sharing those feelings with someone who can help you gain new perspective on those feelings is the way you get unstuck. But of course, it's so hard to self-motivate to do that when you're in the throes of it. But, you know, we all find our own way. I think one thing you continually say to me is, remember to be kind to yourself, which is such a motherly thing to say to your sister, you know?
Like, well, I think it's, you know, I mean,
you're very much like my older sister, who we find out later in life was actually my mom.
Yeah. And then I just like sister. Had you really young. Yeah. for sure. But I do, you know, it's like, I think that it's interesting that you talk about it as mothering, because as someone who lost my mother very young, I have had to figure out how to like mother myself a little bit. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? So I, you know, when you lose a parent very young, or you have like, you know, whether that's, you know, they die or bail or whatever, there is a way that that can kind of, you lose that nurturing at a certain point. And so later in life, you realize like, oh, I have to figure out how to talk to that young me in a way that makes them feel cared for. So I've had to cultivate that language so much for myself. It's actually very easy for me to like spit it out, you know, at other people that I see struggling, but it's not like, excuse me, it's not like some easy natural thing that, like, you know what I mean? Like that's years and years of work. So,
yeah. And you are now 40, and that's a lot of years to be working at.
That's a lot of years. It's really weird to be like a queer 40-year-old person, because like what? I don't know. It's so weird. I don't feel 40. I do feel 40. It's weird.
Is it because when we were growing up, I mean, you're 40. I just turned 34. So you're not that much older than me. We grew up just on the cusp of the same kind of generational shift, you know.
But real quick, I am not that much older than you is what I think until I'm filtering photos of the two of us together. And then I'm mad. Anyway, continue.
Oh, I thought you were saying because of my juvenile tendency to make, you know.
Oh, no, it's
Instagram
literally
faces
that I'm
photos.
Like, okay, I'll take out these blemishes, these lines, these wrinkles, whatever. And then I'm like, okay, now I'll edit Jinx to be nice so we both look. And then I'm like, well, there's a zit on her forehead. I guess that's, I'll take care of that,
often
I guess.
There's zits on my forehead.
But you literally don't have any lines on your face. It's infuriating.
I feel differently, but thank you. I was going to say, you know, when I was a young queer person, I came out at like 14, between the years of 13 and 15. By 15, I was fully out and already doing drag. I do remember believing what I was told by what few aspects of queer culture that I could get from media. You know, we had Queer as Folk. Not the original, because the original was British, but the original American one, which was actually shot in Canada. the all white, all pretty cast of Queer as Folk, telling me what it was like to be an aging gay person, you know? So I was like 15 watching these men talk about how their life ends at 30 in the queer community. And I really thought that was real. I really thought, oh, by the time I'm 30, I better have everything figured out because my life as a queer person just comes to a grinding halt. And now here I am at 34 and I'm like, no, my life really just started. Like my 20s were all just like training for how to be an effective person in my 30s. God I learned those lessons in my 20s, because if I was still working on those things, I don't know if I would have made it to 34.
Well, I was a mess in my 20s, and my 30s got increasingly good as they went on. I loved my 30s, and you know, I have positive thoughts about my 40s. My friends who are in their 40s sort of say that same thing, which is that each decade kind of gets better, you know. But you said something else that made me think of something else that I wanted to say.
Queer as Folk, queer representation in media.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know. I was about to say not to get too dark, but fuck it. To get dark, like we're talking about this stuff, you know, you say that, you know, talk about this idea of life ending at 30. Like I literally, as a teenager, I thought about suicide so much. I literally didn't think I was going to live to 30. Like I could not, like I just had it in my head, like kind of hang on till your 20s, something might improve. But like, I did not think that I would make it to the age of 30. So every year past that has felt like bonus time. And now I'm like, holy shit, my life is great. And it is just beginning. Like it does feel like I'm just at the beginning of my life. And like all the other stuff, it's like, you know, when you have that mentality, you go into the rest of your life just like, there's very little to lose. Like, this is time I didn't expect to have. I'm going to make the most of it, you know? And I think that's the flip side of this type of dark stuff that we don't often like to talk about, right? Like, the other side of the coin is actually very shiny.
That's a really good saying. The other side of the coin is actually very shiny.
I just made that up. I'm just poetic.
Getting back into some more, like...
You don't want to talk about suicide some more?
We can talk about suicide as long as you want.
No. What do we got?
It's your time.
It's your time. You're my therapist.
I have one more kind of lifestyle, bigger question, and then I'll ask a few more of these, like, these more like, what's your favorite food questions? But so you've also been very outspoken about trans rights and trans issues. Your partner, your fiance, Gus, is trans. You've had partners in the past who are trans. Do you feel like a spokesperson for trans rights? How does that work into your public persona?
I don't think about myself as, you know, I'm not an activist. I'm not on the front lines. I mean, I'm an activist in the way that those of us who like speak openly about the things that matter to us, even if it's, you know, if there's resistance, and those of us who like put that into our art, like our activists. But it's just like another thing about my life, much like the mental health piece, that is like, it's part of my life. It's a big part of my life. And I was embarrassed and like felt weird to talk about this stuff for many, many years, you know, and I'm just like done with that, you know, because I, as you said, I have dated predominantly trans men since my early 20s. And that has, that's complicated in a lot of ways, because not only is there a lot of stigma within the cisgendered community around that, especially with, you know, in the gay male community, you know, that was a thing that if it ever came up that my partner was trans for many years, that was a thing that people would mock or make light of or whatever.
Yeah.
But also within the trans community, there are these issues of fetishization. There are issues of people being attracted to trans people, but wanting to do it on like the down low in a way that's connected to shame. And I, for many years, felt very afraid of self-identifying as someone who is attracted to trans men because
transamorous.
Yes. Well, you know, I didn't want to identify that way because also I didn't, it was kind of, you know, I'm whatever. I can't not, it's like, I don't know how not to allude to the term. Right. Like we do not use the word anymore, but was a very common term to describe people who are attracted to trans people. And within the trans community, that was a very, very negative thing. And so I was like, I don't know how to think about this. And it wasn't that you and I were together when Our Lady J came backstage and I was talking about my partner who is trans, and she goes, oh, I didn't know you were transamorous. And I never heard a positive word to describe people who are attracted to trans people. And I'm like, oh my God, let's all talk about this all the time. Because, you know, when I started talking publicly about my partner being trans, every single show I did touring for like a year, a couple would come up to me, oftentimes a cisgender drag queen with their trans male partner, and be like, oh my God, we thought we were the only ones. And it was every city.
Well, you were talking about the special, you know, like the extra layers of stigma when you keep zeroing in on our communities. Like, you know, first there's the cisgender community, then the gay male community. And I think another layer is just amongst drag queens. And there's so many stereotypes. There's so many, like, very old, very false stereotypes about drag queens, you know, misconceptions of drag queens and their gender identities just for the fact that they do drag.
Yeah.
And then I remember whenever a drag queen would learn that you were in a relationship with a trans male, they started treating you like a fetishist, or they immediately made it a fetish thing. And I think that's because there was so many of those internalized stereotypes that even drag queens take on and start to believe for themselves because it's been foisted on them for so long. And I remember that it just, like, kind of seemed like a does not compute thing for so many of our fellow drag friends.
Yeah.
And nowadays, I think it's very, very different. A lot of these misconceptions are being broken down. And that's because of people openly having conversations about their own experiences. And just like you said, you know, finding a word that was positive, that wasn't directly associated with fetishization. So I think part of the progress that our community is seeing, where we're not thinking so much in strict terms of binary and you know, like, because I'm this, I'm supposed to be attracted to this, or because I'm a drag queen, I'm supposed to be attracted to, you know, straight acting men with giant dicks who wreck my hole every other night. You know, like, I feel like that was a stereotype that I dealt with as a drag queen. I was like, I'm a drag queen.
And now
queen,
you've just
so...
embraced it.
Now I've just embraced it. I'm a drag queen, so I have to. I mean, I definitely, as a drag queen and a self-identified trans person, I know that I oftentimes, you know,
love getting your hole wrecked.
I was going to say went after straight acting, straight presenting, right. Or yeah. Bi-curious men, because that fed... It fed a certain aspect of my femininity. It validated a certain aspect of my femininity. But it was really me playing into stereotypes that I didn't even necessarily agree with. And now that I have identified that, it's like I have my partner who is not at all straight acting, not at all like that archetype. But, you know, I know where the attraction comes from, and I know why I was attracted to, like, straight skater boys for so long, and I know how to find that validation outside of subjecting myself to fetishization. You know?
Yeah, well, I mean, I, you know, it was, like, same for many, many years. I felt like the more sort of, I mean, not just masculine and straight acting, but, like, I mean, like, in college... I was like, let's see how many straight guys we can sleep with. You know what I mean? Like, and that was so validating. I was like, if I can get a super masculine straight guy, then that, like, means something positive about me, which is such negative self-speak as a queer person. It's so much crazy internalized homophobia to, like, think that that's what makes you, like, I don't know, like, it gives you credibility. I'm not sure what.
Yeah. I mean, it was similar for me, as in I slept with a lot of bi-curious or straight identified guys in college. But I mean, it was validating for me and my femininity, and validating for my own feelings of, you know, like, how attractive I found myself. But it definitely, like, the other side of that is you begin to feel like, oh, no one actually loves me. No one actually wants to be with me. They just want to have this experience and then go on. And oftentimes it was like a dirty little secret. And I just reached a point in my life where I was like, I don't feel like I want to be anyone's dirty little secret anymore.
Yeah, it's really isolating. It's a bummer.
It's a bummer, but awareness is half the battle. Identifying it is half the battle. And once you identify why you do certain things and repeat certain patterns, then at least it's like, then you can choose to continue doing that in any form. And once it's a choice, it feels very different. It can feel very liberating, you know, when you know, oh, I do this because it gives me this payoff. So here's how I'm going to selectively do that in a way where I gain the benefits from it, but not then go into a shame spiral afterward.
Yes. Yeah.
And absolutely. A lot of that's just about owning your sexuality, sexual revolution, blah, 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 blah.
Burn our bras.
Burn our bras. If we did that, we'd be, what would we do on stage? Free balling our fake
Smalls.
Boobs. Okay. We're going to go a little over because you're one of my best friends. You deserve a little bit more time, but I'm going to ask,
I'm having fun. I don't want to stop talking.
I know, me neither. What's the craziest experience that happened when working together? And this can also go into best and worst tour moments.
What do you got? What do you got?
Do I tell the birthday story?
Oh, God, that story is so boring to me, but it's just because Gus, it's his favorite, my partner Gus, it's his favorite story and he makes me tell it constantly, so I get very bored. Go for it. Every time I say a story is boring and somebody else to tell it, I start interjecting and correcting them constantly, yeah. So buckle up.
Oh, I know. We're in San Francisco. We're doing, was it Hokum Pokum?
Yes.
Must have been Hokum Pokum.
Yes.
You and I.
Because it was my first show with Peaches. That was like Peaches Christ, who I had admired for a very long time. That was my first opportunity to work with her. And I was so nervous and I really wanted to impress her.
And early in the rehearsal, it was your birthday and we were in San Francisco. All our friends were up in Seattle. So I organized a birthday thing. Admittedly, I mostly invited people I knew. I thought I was inviting like a ton of mutual friends, but yeah, it was like I threw a party with all of my friends for your birthday.
I had forgotten that detail. Yes, it was very much like that.
I only remember it because drunkenly at one point in the night you said, "Well, thanks, Jinx, for organizing this birthday party with all your friends."
No, I actually do remember that now, but yeah.
But while you were on your birthday tear, you ended up bringing home a go-go dancer. Well, we thought he was a go-go dancer. Turns out he was just someone at the club in his underwear.
I'd sort of like to clarify that I was a very talented drunk. I'll put it that way at this point in my life. And I do not actually party like that anymore. But yes.
I don't remember the last time I partied with you like that. But you are a very talented drunk. You have lots of tricks to kind of hide how drunk you are. One is maintaining eye contact.
I don't think that's really true. I don't really get that drunk anymore, but I used to drink like a monster.
Like,
and I was very good
at hiding it. We both did.
We
used to drink like it was our job.
Yes.
And one of my favorite drunk moments of you was you were trying to plug the audio jack into a laptop, but you wouldn't break eye contact with me because that would show how drunk you were.
Well, you didn't realize I was drunk. The way you told it to me the next day was that you did not realize I was drunk because I was talking to you fully coherently, making like not breaking eye contact. And then you looked down at my hand and saw that I was like trying to plug this thing into the stereo hole and not just missing the hole, but missing the full stereo.
For like a solid 5 minutes.
And then another point, I was pulling the same trick. Again, this is just hearsay. This is what you told me the next day, but I was pulling the same trick. My face said I was fine. And then you looked down and I was trying to pour Maker's Mark into a glass in my hand and I was just pouring it all over the floor.
So this night on your birthday, you bring who we think is a go-go dancer back to the Airbnb. Y'all have some crazy, we assume
well,
you're having
he was,
crazy.
He was dancing. He was dancing in his underwear on the bar. Like, of course he was a go-go dancer.
We assume you're having crazy loud sex, but really he's dancing around your bedroom and putting on makeup and fully having his own
it wasn't what I
journey
hoped
and experience.
It would be.
And then the next day we're at rehearsal, you're hungover, and he shows up at the rehearsal still just in underwear. And then we realize he wasn't a go-go dancer.
Abbreviated.
He was just He wasn't a go-go dancer. He was just someone who only wears underwear.
He was just like, you know, he was just like, yes, it was. It turned out he was not a go-go dancer at the place. And the next day, I was so cripplingly, first of all, there were a lot of details to the evening, like our friend Kenny, who I love very much and who has been your friend forever and worked as your assistant and helps you book things and does everything in your life. Kenny was so mad at me because the next morning there was somehow in my bedroom at the Airbnb, there was lipstick all over the ceiling. Do you remember this?
Yeah.
And
like he
this
was
go-go dancer,
on the bed, drawing on the ceiling with
this supposed
lipstick.
Go-go dancer had also decided to take a shower and shave his entire body in the middle of the night with Kenny's razors.
Yeah. Which
Kenny was so mad.
You can feel violated when someone uses your razor, especially to shave their entire body.
Yeah. Okay, but so then the next day, I was so cripplingly hungover and I wanted to impress Peaches so much because this was our first rehearsal together, but I could barely see straight, let alone hit the blocking, let alone know my lines. And I was already like so embarrassed and trying to hide how hungover I was. And then that's when this crazy drug-addled naked man walks into rehearsal and Peaches is just looking at me with that slack-jawed look of disdain that she gives.
She's and famous for it.
I thought, I was just like, we're never going to work together again. She hates me so much. And the other thing was that Peaches' mom was there at rehearsal.
Diane!
And who I love, and now we have a wonderful relationship, but she like was so like, you know, genuinely concerned, but also like, what the fuck is going on with this person? But for years, every time I saw her, she would walk up to me, put her hand on my shoulder, lock eyes and say, are you making good choices?
I feel it's worth noting now that you are. I mean, that was so uncharacteristic for you at the time. You know, like we had plenty of drunken nights together. It's amazing we never ended up in the same orgy. This is one of my favorite stories besides that last one is we were out drinking one night in full drag. We went to a house party together. I passed out and you thought I left. So I was just left at this house party of complete strangers to me. And I fell asleep in full drag on this couch. And you took off that evening and I woke up the next morning. I woke up to the sound of a heel falling off of my foot and hitting the floor.
Oh my God, I'd forgotten this.
In full drag, I wake up and realize, I don't know where I am. I don't know these people whose
This was in Seattle, right?
In Seattle.
Yeah, yeah.
But luckily, when I left the apartment building, I was only a couple blocks away from my house. And the troubling thing, though, was that I had a music rehearsal 30 minutes later.
Oh my God.
Like I woke up at 9:00. At 9:30, I had music rehearsal and my friend who was picking me up like texted and said, I'm on the way. And I'm in full drag. And then there was no time to get out of drag and like make myself look not hungover. So I stayed in drag, went to this music rehearsal in full drag. No one knew why. I was going to be performing the song, you know, like at the showcase. I was going to be performing it in drag. So I said that I needed to come in full drag for the rehearsal. Everyone was baffled by it. I looked like a vampire queen. We had some crazy times back in Seattle.
We really
did.
And now
look at us. We're old. We're old. I'm sober. And like now our conversations and our crazy times consist of like like creative problem solving for the pets in our houses.
Yeah.
And how we're going to work pet furniture into our decor.
There's no room. I want that hanging chair, that vintage basket hanging chair, but it can't fit it anywhere in my house. It's too much furniture. I will say that I'm so incredibly proud of you for your sobriety. I really just think it's like amazing. And I know that that was like a really big thing for you. And I'm just like consistently impressed that you were, that you did that, that you've stuck by it. I mean, I feel very blessed in that I stopped drinking so much because I just got too tired and old to keep drinking like that. But you know, you had to make a really conscious effort, and I just think it's incredible. I don't know that if I was I was dealing with the same situation, you know, I don't know that I would have been that strong, and I'm just, I think it's amazing.
Well, thank you. Your your kind words about it mean especially a lot to me, since you were with me during one of my worst moments of my drinking.
Life ball.
Which was, we were on the Life Ball plane.
Oh my God. This is the story that I really wanted to tell at the top, but then
go
I was
ahead,
like,
go ahead.
No. You go for it. I just was maybe she doesn't want it.
And then you tell it, and then I'm going to wrap up this podcast.
Okay. I don't know that I remember all the details specifically, but it was just that we were on that plane to Life Ball, which is.
And for people who don't know, all the performers and all the like the big names attending Life Ball go together from America on this one plane and then land. And then there is a red carpet waiting for you when you get off the plane. So everyone has to get all dolled up and
with
red
like
carpet
a media
ready
blitz,
on the
yeah.
plane.
And the plane is so crazy because it's like Amanda Lepore bouncing around naked with champagne, like on, you know what I mean? Like to like Roseanne was on the plane. Paula Abdul was on the plane. It was like so
Kelly
weird.
Osbourne. I think Courtney Love.
And everyone's Courtney Love.
Yeah, I think she was on the plane too.
Really? I missed that.
It
Are you sure
that year?
I think that was your reflection. But I because we all have to get. We all have to get into drag, like those of us who are drag queens, like Roseanne didn't have to get into drag, but those of us who had to get into drag on this flight. And so we're literally in just like an airplane bathroom trying to do full makeup or like having our mirror set up on our tray table. And, you know, I think I was sitting next to Shangela and we were both And
that was my last memory of the evening, was you and me and Shangela in a bathroom. And I was almost ready. That's the thing that really kicks me in the pants is that I was almost ready.
We were all like celebrating on the plane, but you were hitting it hard, and you it was like by the time the plane landed, you were like not super skilled at talking and or walking, and. While your face had started while you were still coherent, by the time the final layers happened, like the lipstick and the liner, it was absolutely the end of Death Becomes Her. It was absolutely just like these smears and smudges that were vaguely related to a sense memory of where your mouth hole was, like, it, you know, just like muscle memory of putting on mascara. And so we... we get off the plane. It's like, it was, you know, I had never been in a situation like that. It's this huge, long red carpet. It is all this media and photos being taken, interviews, cameras, all these things. And I look behind me and you are being helped down the stairs of the plane, literally looking like Meryl in that final scene, trying to make her way out of the funeral. And it was, I think there was like, somebody started interviewing you and I think you were nodding off instead of answering the questions. And I think I had to like grab you under the shoulder and like haul you off the red carpet. Well, look at you now.
And the lesson there, folks, is if you're on antidepressants and they tell you not to mix with alcohol, do not mix it with
Yeah.
Oh, it's sad. I had to learn it, and I had to learn that lesson in such a high stakes way. Luckily, no footage has ever surfaced.
Yeah.
I really got a freebie there. The the worst part of the whole story is I recently deleted it. I've reached a point in my sobriety where I was like, I'm going to delete this video and let go of the past and forgive myself, because I had so much shame around that event. But I had to just play it off like a joke. I had to just joke about it with everyone, because that was the only way to get through it. But I had this like 40-minute video of, I was using my phone as a mirror to try to put my lashes on. And it's a 40-minute video of just trying to put my lashes on in a blackout. And I keep putting them on wrong and then taking them off and putting them on again. And by the end, that's why my eyes were just big black circles.
My God, you have never told me this. I can't believe that I never got to see this video before it was erased from the earth.
I couldn't really watch it. It made me so upset to watch it, but I kept it on my phone as a reminder of like why I'm quitting drinking. And I recently deleted it because I felt like carrying it around with me was just carrying around like a dead body that I didn't want people
to see.
That
makes sense. Yeah. But, you know, and I think that had you not made such incredible positive change in your life, I certainly wouldn't be talking about this, you know, obviously there's the tragedy of this is diffused by the fact that it is in the end a story of triumph. So we can kind of laugh about the details.
I mean,
right.
And it's funny. I mean, it's funny. It didn't feel funny at the time. It felt very, you know, eye opening, but it is also funny to just know that I got off this plane, stepped onto a red carpet, looking fully like a corpse and just barely coming out of a blackout. But, you know, hunting's dangerous. These are the questions that I ask everyone on my podcast at the end of the episode. Answer them however you like. Who is your celebrity crush today?
Oh, my God. Why don't I have an immediate answer to that?
I don't know.
Who?
Maybe it's because you've been working so hard on the show that you haven't been looking at celebrity
I know.
Crushes.
I'm like, what's media? And then I'm like, okay, well, try not today. Like, who have you ever been attracted to? I can't remember. Who have I talked about being boned
I know.
Up for?
I know. The adult film actor, Bo Banks.
Oh, yeah. Bo Banks is really something.
Bo Banks,
although it's really,
listening.
You know, I have to say, there's like a different level. I feel like you just like called me out in a different way, because as soon as you, right, like if I was like Nick Jonas, it's like, oh, okay, you listen to music. But if I'm like Bo Banks, then it's like, you know, suddenly it's like everybody's picturing me.
Oh my gosh. With Instagram, you don't have to be a porn star fan to know about porn stars.
Let's be real. Who just follows a porn star on Instagram?
Oh my God. I follow constant porn stars. I'm constantly following porn stars. I see a porn I like, I go follow the porn stars.
Yeah, no, I'm saying that who is following a porn star on Instagram without seeing their porn? Like whether or not you saw the porn first, you don't go check it out later if you're following a porn star.
Listen, there's nothing wrong with enjoying the adult arts.
Oh no, God, no! I celebrate that in a major way. I mean, I think like God bless. Oh my God, my mic. God bless Bo Banks and all the adult film stars who like man, oh man, got us through quarantine. If
Absolutely.
Not our entire lives beforehand. I mean, like if you're like stuck in a room with your partner for, you know, 18 months, it doesn't mean your sex life is declining, but you know, sometimes you got to fill in the gaps.
It takes a little more butter to get back in the frying pan.
Exactly.
I'm going to say my celebrity crush. Hold on. I have to look it up real quick.
Okay, I'm glad I'm not the only one who didn't know their celebrity crush.
No, I come up with a new one every time. Okay, my celebrity crush that I'm going to name drop today is Alan Kazer, who played Bubba Higgins on Mama's Family. He was, I don't know if I've used this one before, but he was a sex god to me when I was a small human being watching Mama's Family at 6 a.m. every morning when I got ready for school.
You've never mentioned this to me. Actually, though, I will just say real quick that somebody who I really have a huge crush on is Manny Jacinto, who was in the last... Oh. He was just in Seven Perfect Strangers, but he's from The Good Place before that is how I know him. And he plays Jason Mendoza, like the burnout from Florida. And it is like... I really have an issue with, like, just, like, handsome, like, dumb characters. Like, Jason Mendoza are, like,
I've copped to that as well. Handsome dum-dums, you know, fictional character dum-dums who have the best hearts. You know, if they were just dum-dums, but they're dum-dums with the sweetest hearts and the best of intentions.
Yes,
and that
exactly.
Really does it for me.
Well, and the performance is so good, and that's hot, and the cheekbones, yeah. And the put it all together. And
he's definitely been one of my celebrity crush answers. Next question is, are you spiritual?
You know, funny you should ask that, Jinx. I was very spiritual growing up. I was raised Unitarian and was part of a Unitarian Universalist youth group, which, you know, is essentially non-denominational, but there's a lot of, like, spiritual ritual. And I really lost touch with that as an adult. And it's something that I've really been trying to reconnect with just kind of even since pandemic started, because I have had a chance to slow down and realize that I'm very... You know, I've gotten the analysis down. I've gotten the work down. I do the mental work, but the spiritual piece is something that I've lost touch with. So, you know, I had an exorcism recently. I know I told you about that, and
yeah,
that was cool.
I have noticed you using more. We always, you know, we always preface it in our conversations of this is very hippie woo woo, but I'm going to say it. But I have noticed you using more of your hippie woo woo language lately.
Yeah.
What is your go-to karaoke song? I already know the answer to this.
It's Mr. Boombastic. It's Shaggy's Mr. Boombastic. It's one of my favorites. I think it's been a while. I want to do some karaokeing.
I remember a night in Provincetown, we were at like a late night karaoke thing. I sang Me and Bobby McGee and you sang Mr. Boombastic and we closed the place down.
It always brings the house down.
Yeah.
It can't go wrong with Shaggy. You know what? You're never too drunk to hit the notes.
Finally, do you have anything you'd like to promote? Where can our listeners find you online? I'm sure most of my listeners already follow you because I won't shut up about you, but...
Anything to promote? Oh, what about the Jinx and Dela Holiday Show live coming to a theater near you? This November, if you're in the UK and some places in Canada and the US, and then December in the... U.S. Well, whatever. We're all over the place.
We're all
you
over
and me,
the place.
Baby.
Yeah. And this is our third year touring and our fourth consecutive year creating a holiday show. And,
yeah.
Post-pandemic artistic creation has been a very special challenge, but we're finding our way. And it's a good thing we have 3 years under the belt before trying to create a show post-pandemic, because
I gotta say though, I am so proud of where we're at with this. Like, I love what we've created this year. I really
and Major Scales has really brought it on the music front, uh-huh. And we're going for some big concepts and for some high payoffs, and I'm excited as well. I just bought a new little desk for my laptop so that I can write. We're about to enter into an intensive writing weekend, and I don't want to be stuck in my office the whole time. So I got one of those little like TV trays for your laptop, so I can write in bed. And I got one of those pillows with the arms, so I can sit up in bed and be comfortable while I'm writing for hours and hours.
I like that you're like, I don't want to be stuck in the office, so I'm just going to be bedridden.
I actually do a lot of my best work in bed. Heyo.
Oh wow.
Well. Thank you, Ben de la Creme, for being my guest on this super packed, extra long episode of Hijinks.
Let's keep going.
I didn't tell you, but the next guest had to reschedule in the middle of our conversation. So that's why I was able to have a luxurious and lengthy conversation with you.
Wow. I'm really honored that you...
It was going to happen one way or another.
It really means a lot to me that you involuntarily cleared your schedule for this. Thank you.
Well, thank you so much for being my guest. And thank you all so much for listening to Hijinks here on the Forever Dog and Moguls of Media Network. My name is Jinx Monsoon, and we have new episodes every Wednesday. So make sure to search for Hijinks on your favorite podcast app and hit subscribe. You can follow me at The Jinx on Instagram or at Jinx Monsoon everywhere else. You can follow Benda LaCreme at Benda LaCreme. Everywhere. Benda La Cram. Benda La.
Why are you saying it like this?
I don't know. I know.
It's like the first time you've ever said my name.
Well, I just don't think a lot of people know that every syllable is capitalized in your name because it's all your name.
But fortunately, when you're looking at something on Instagram, it's it zero matter. Difference. But you do have to understand that it's not spelled Benda La.
Benda LaCreme. Follow her at Benda LaCreme on all your social medias. And I'll see you all next Wednesday for some more hijinks.
Forever.
To listen to Hijinks ad-free and one day early, sign up for Forever Dog Plus at foreverdogpodcasts.com/plus. Make sure to follow at Forever Dog Team and at Mom Podcasts on social and rate and review Hijinks 5 stars on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Stitcher, or wherever you get your podcasts. Hijinks is produced by Forever Dog and Moguls of Media, aka Mom, hosted by me, Jinx Monsoon, produced by Big Dipper, editing and sound design by Will Pitts, executive produced by Willem Belli, Alaska Thunderfuck, Brett Boehm, Joe Cilio, and Alex Ramsey.